Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday afternoon. As I have mentioned on the blog, what we're going to do today is look at a textual variant at Luke 23:34. I'm not sure how long this will take. Might take the whole hour. Might take 20 minutes. I don't know. Sort of hard to say. So we might be continuing on with the examination of the Sola Scriptura debate from 1993. We might not. Don't know. We'll find out. All depends if other folks participate or, you know, whatever else it might be. We will see. I am joined today online by Alan Kirshner. Hi, Alan. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Folks might know you from that lovely caricature of you on our blog. Alan is one of the team apologion. You may have seen a lot of his blogs have to do with textual critical issues. The King James only folks just love Alan, and probably like Turretin fan today, there was a Roman Catholic who identified him as one of my minions. He has now been elevated to minion status, so I would imagine there's probably some King James only folks out there that have elevated you to minion status as well. Which is always good argumentation, you know, when people approach things that way. But the reason I asked Alan to join me today is...
By the way, Dr. White, I was just going to say, I think this might be my initiation to the Alexandrian cult.
Oh, yes, the Alexandrian cult, yes. did you get your robe and the purple toga?
No, but I have a feeling after this show I might.
Well, we thought we'd rush the purple toga to you fast enough, but if it didn't get there, I'm sorry about that. But anyway, I am looking at a certain paper that Alan wrote. This would have been last year, or when was this?
Yeah, about 2 years ago, I took a New Testament textual critical course at Harvard Divinity with Eldon Epp, and we had to choose one variant for a major paper, a final paper, and so I chose Luke 23:34a.
Right. Now, I guess that would have been section 1884. I was looking at your title. It says Harvard Divinity School 1884. I was going, boy, you've aged well, actually.
Right. That's the course number there.
Now, I put on the blog for people who wanted to see this. I gave the text, and it is a very, very familiar text. But Jesus was saying, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. This is one of the sayings of Jesus from the cross. Now, I admit that I don't know how long it was before I recognized that there is even a variant here, but I know I did not realize there was a variant when I first wrote The Potter's Freedom, for example, because when I dealt with this text and Norman Geisler's use of it, I made no reference to it, and I pretty clearly remember realizing this at some point at a later time. And I believe you actually said your first footnote referenced me for bringing this variant to your attention. So evidently it would have been after the same time that I ran across this particular variant then.
Yeah, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago you brought that to my attention, and I knew I was going to be taking a course in textual criticism, and so I kind of kept it in the back of my mind to do further investigation on it, and so.
Yeah, now it's interesting. Someone might ask, how in the world could you look at a text very often without noticing textual variants? And it's pretty simple. The primary Bible program I use is BibleWorks. And unfortunately, up to this point in time, BibleWorks still doesn't have the textual data. Now, you can get the Tischendorf stuff finally, but generally, as you're just looking at the text on the screen and you're utilizing that, cutting and pasting and looking at the Greek and things like that, there's no critical text that. Does Accordance have the critical text material?
Accordance does not. In fact, I believe BibleWorks and Accordance, they have a third party that's the German
Stuttgart,
correct. Yeah. That provides the textual data in the NA 27.
That actually, it's Libronics that has the Stuttgart Electronic Study Bible, but BibleWorks still doesn't. They were going to have it in 7.0, but the project's way behind. You know how textual critics are, and so it hasn't been completed yet, but that's coming out of a completely different group. So,
yeah.
As I was looking at the text in BibleWorks, there's no indication of the variant, and I forgot to look. I'm not sure if you may have looked, but have you ever run across an English translation that made note of the variant? Because I'm unaware of.
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because I've looked at other, you know how some modern English translations will have, there's a small handful of verses that they regulate to the footnotes, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, look at some of those, you know, the weight of the external evidence, and some of them are very similar to this one, except some of them will have Aleph and Vaticanus together and whatnot, but very similar, and it's interesting that, you know, I kind of find a little inconsistency when it comes to this variant. Now, some English translations will regulate, you know, they'll make a footnote, you know, and say, you know, some early manuscripts
right.
will, do not have this, or else, in fact, I think the NET Bible, the NET Bible,
yeah.
puts it in brackets, actually, in the text. So that's, you know, that's interesting. But as far as, like, for example, I think in a previous chapter of Luke, that's where the variant with the, you know, the drops of Jesus' blood is.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not mistaken, I think that's regulated to the footnote or not. I have to look at that again. But in fact, I was looking at some commentators, like Bach, you know, with his commentary on Luke,
mm-hmm.
and Marshall. And it seems like they say, yes, this is a significant variant, but it seems that's the extent that they go. And both of them, of course, believe that it is original.
Original, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, certainly we could say that the provision of English footnotes and whether you relegate something to the footnote or something like that is not exactly an exact science in most translations, and the standards that are used as to whether a note could be inserted or not are not overly uniform, but all I know is I was probably in my 40s or close to my 40s before I even recognized this, and I don't think that I saw that in reading commentary or anything like that. I just happened to see it in the textual material, which means this text is normally discussed without any reference to the fact that there is a rather major textual variant. So let's explain what that is for folks, because a lot of folks get a little bit nervous when we start talking about this particular subject. And so on the blog, I have provided a scan from Swanson, and you included Swanson's work, New Testament Greek manuscripts. There's have they expanded beyond Acts? Because I have Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts.
I wonder if they. I don't think they have, but I could be mistaken on that.
Yeah, I've got those. I forget where I got them from, but Reuben Swanson's the editor. For people who are interested in looking at this, it's a different way of providing the textual information. Sometimes it's a little bit easier for people to visualize what the variants are by putting it in this table format that we have on the blog and that you also reproduced in your paper, and
it is a nice bird's eye view, you know, versus say, and you can see something real quick versus maybe the NA 27, and I mean, albeit it is just the Greek witnesses, but still,
And it doesn't take that much effort to figure out what the Greek witnesses are. So people who are looking at the blog, and if you're listening to this at a later time, you can go back to the blog for September 4th, 2008, to see this particular graphic if you want to see it. My recollection is that Swanson collates against Vaticanus, if I recall correctly. So the very first line, you see 34, then OM stands for omit, and therefore there's nothing beyond that except for the list of witnesses, which includes Vaticanus, which is B, then P75, which I believe is the earliest papyri manuscript for this section of Luke that we have in our possession.
Right, yeah, right. It's the earliest copy of Luke that we have.
Right. Then we have the Aleph with a C next to it. Now, then down at the bottom line, you also have an Aleph with an asterisk next to it. Why don't you explain to folks what the difference between those two is?
Are you looking at the...
The Greek witnesses here, we're looking at Swanson, Aleph with a C and Aleph with an asterisk. Why would Aleph be listed twice?
Oh, right. For Swanson, you know, there's different nomenclature for the NA27 here. But, the asterisk would be that this is a...
the original reading.
The T is referring to a corrector. That's
right.
What it is.
Yeah, right.
It's referring to a corrector. And actually, it was corrected again with the inclusion of it. Originally, for Aleph, it's saying that it has it, and then the corrector came along and,
expunged it.
And then another corrector came by and then added it as well. So.
And that's actually what the large graphic below that is exactly that. You can see the text there and how it has been altered in that particular point. That actually is Sinaiticus, Codex Sinaiticus, which is coming online. I don't think Luke has been put online yet. I forgot to check before the program to see if... if Luke had been added, but eventually people will be able to grab hold of those particular graphics themselves and look very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have D with the same type of asterisks, and we can see down below there's a correction of that.
Right.
Except this time it's the corrector who added it in. At a later point in time. Then, interesting, Codex W, which is a primarily Byzantine witness. Now, I know we're throwing some stuff out here, and some folks are going, what in the world are you people talking about?
Well, actually, maybe reassure the readers here, you know, obviously, pun intended, this is going to sound like Greek, but, you know, once we get into, I think, some of the internal evidence, I think they'll be able to follow that a lot more. So, obviously, in textual criticism, for those who don't know, you go to the external evidence first, the actual witnesses, because they are more objective, and then you're in a position to be able to maybe judge, with internal considerations against the external evidence.
Right, right. So we have these uncial manuscripts. Uncial meaning majuscules. They're written in a particular form. They're the earlier manuscripts. W is now B. And Aleph are considered what are called Alexandrian, primarily Alexandrian manuscripts. Sinaiticus, as I believe you noted in your paper, has some Western influence at some points in it, but primarily Alexandrian, P75 and Vaticanus, those are the two premier Alexandrian manuscripts, which have been vilified many, many times by King James-only advocates, but for no particularly decent reason.
And then when you have P75, Papyrus 75, combined with Vaticanus B, that's very weighty.
That's considered to be very weighty by most modern critical scholars. That's right. So W, however, is not in the Alexandrian family, so to have it in this particular list is rather intriguing. It's something that you address, and we'll look at that a little bit later on in your comments. Then Theta and others, in essence, likewise do not have this particular phrase. Then it's found in the following forms. And with the small difference of, for example, Codex A, Alexandrinus does not have the word pater, which means father.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have some minor differences. For example, the corrector of D has, instead of T for what they are doing, has the definite article te, which probably has to do with the Latin, the fact it's influenced by the Latin, probably more than anything else. The scribe probably just wasn't paying close attention there. Then we have, interesting enough, manuscript 33, which is a very important minuscule manuscript that most people feel is a copy of a much earlier exemplar, which has a slight difference in the tense of the verb. But one of the things that you noted in all of these is that, aside from very minor form variations, everything that's a part of this text, all the way down to the bottom of the line where you have the original Sinaiticus, you have C, you have what looks like it's called a fractur M, which means the majority text, which is the entire Byzantine manuscript tradition, L, N, Q, many others, family 1, family 13, the vast bulk of Greek manuscripts do contain this, but of course the vast bulk of Greek manuscripts come from at least 800-900-1,000 years after the time of Christ. So the Byzantine manuscript tradition clearly contains this particular phraseology. This is a variant that clearly comes up from the second century. But what you pointed out, and I think it's very important, is there isn't much variation amongst these witnesses as to what's being said here. And you brought up a very important point, and that was, if someone was trying to just modify this, try to sort of change it a little bit, they might want to just change one word. They might want to make it very specific who Jesus was praying for, et cetera, et cetera. They don't do that. There's no meaningful theological difference between any of the variants that are listed here.
Yeah, and I was going to discuss a little bit about that, you know, consider some of that internal evidence, because you would think it's an anomaly. I think that if you have a certain theological tendency, but with no theological variation within the clause itself. In other words, the witnesses, you know, they're either being omitted or they are intact for the most part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think most textual critics would see that as a demonstration that this is an interpolation and not a excision.
Right. So let's make sure people understand that. And interpolation is where something, and this is a fairly lengthy variant. I mean, most variants are only a word or some word order or something like that. This is a pretty decent logion that we're looking at here. You either decide that it has been excised, that is, it was there originally and it has been pulled out, or it's an insertion. It has been put in where it wasn't before. And that really is the question that faces the textual scholar at this particular issue. And, of course, that's just another way of saying, did Luke write it originally or did he not write it originally? Does this reflect the apostolic text? Does it not? And I think, you know, now that I'm thinking back for just a moment, I think that the reason I started looking at this, or I was brought to looking at this, had to do with the fact that when I looked at the Synoptic Gospels, I think that's, now that I'm thinking about it, I think this is what brought it about. I was looking at the parallels, and at this point, Luke is alone in having this material. Mark and Matthew do not have anything like this at this particular point in time, and I think that's what brought my attention to it initially. As I recall, it wasn't a commentary like that. It was something like that. So, in essence, could we summarize, let's summarize the external evidence, and let's start talking about how at least modern scholarship approaches subjects like this.
I was going to say it is interesting that you mentioned W, Frianius, Codex Frianius, because that's a variegated text. And it's a very, Luke, I think it's Luke 8 through 24, actually has a Byzantine type text there.
Right.
And that's where our variant is. So, actually, we have, and not to mention, you have the earliest Syriac you know, of the three versions, that this is interesting too. I know you haven't touched on this yet, but the three most important versions, Syriac, Latin, and Coptic, all of those three, for example, Syriac, the earliest Syriac manuscript there is Sinaitic, which most critics would say is one of the best and earliest ones, does not contain this reading.
Right.
Sahedic, as well, does not contain this.
And part of the Boharic as well.
Yeah, and the Boharic. And, well, some Boharics do, but
it's
some
part,
don't.
Part, it's a part reading, right?
Right, and but that's a later, that would be a later Coptic coming after Sahedic. I think most critics would see this Sahedic is a little bit earlier than that. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the Latin, one of the best Latin, old Latin texts, and by the way, when I meant Syriac, that's old Syriac as well. And as far as the old Latin, you have, which is the old Latin, there's a number of old Latin manuscripts, and one of the best ones, but one of the best earlier ones is A. The small letter A symbolizes this particular manuscript, and which is one of the earliest ones, and it does not contain this reading, too. So here you have three ancient versions, Dr. White, in which they do not contain, and not just early, but high-quality ones that do not contain this reading. And so their exemplars, their Greek exemplars, probably going back to, you know, the early part of the second century, would not have this reading. So I think that just corroborates. So you have actually taken all this together. You have you have early reading, a Western reading, with the Latin, with Codex D. You have Alexandrian, very ancient Alexandrian readings with 75 and Vaticanus.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have actually some would consider Theta, Caesarean, right,
mm-hmm.
As one of the chief representatives of the Caesarean text, although, you know, that's a little bit later, but still. And, of course, the Byzantine, the Codex W. So, wow, I mean, that's pretty convincing, obviously.
Well, let's explain why that's convincing. A reading that has a support that comes from a wide variety of of families and witnesses is more likely to represent a broader geographical distribution rather than one that has only one family in support of it, because if you only have one family, it's not found anywhere else in any of the translations, the early translations, anything like that. If you have it only in one, then you may be looking at an entire family that had a very early exemplar that had a variant in it, and that variant does not represent what went into other places in the early centuries of the distribution of this text. And so when you have a reading that has that wide distribution, that is a weighty thing. You said scholars view it as having more weight. Well, that's where the weight is coming from at that particular point. Correct?
Yes, and I would corroborate that with the genealogical relationship as well, because, you know, it's been known that Alice does have Western influence, and some of these other manuscripts that would include this reading, some Boharic as well, as that Western influence as well. And that's where we find this this reading in a singular tradition, right? In the Western, in fact, to be balanced, it does go back to the second century. There's a Diatessaron that would have this reading. And so we know it does go back to sometime in the second century.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, we see that this is in a singular tradition, and the geographical, as you mentioned, the geographical distribution is very compelling and would suggest that this reading was introduced in the Western transmission sometime during the second century.
And now you're looking at the NA27 information here, which is where it also indicates to us Sinaiticus, both the original and the second corrector, have the text in it. This is one of the places where a fuller text like Swanson is more useful, because it really doesn't give us the same type of level of information that Nassau doesn't give the same level of information as Swanson. But basically what you're saying is the witnesses that have this text are primarily within one textual family, one tradition, whereas the witnesses that do not have a much wider distribution, and hence, just as we summarize the external information, that external information, from your perspective, would point more to the idea this is not original, that phraseology is not original with Luke, just simply on the external. We haven't looked at the internal stuff yet, but
right.
Just the external stuff.
Right, and that's why it's probably good to really exhaust the external first, because when you have, in my view, this convincing external evidence, wide distribution, geographical distribution, attested by some of the best quality early manuscripts, not to mention the genealogical relationship, you really have to keep that in mind, because external evidence is not, it's not equal to internal evidence. In other words, if you have very weighty external evidence and then you have ambiguous internal evidence, which we'll see, I think we have ambiguous internal evidence, the weight would go to the external. So,
okay, so with that then, and by the way, this type of information, you didn't have to go through any special ceremonies to be able to get access to it. You could buy these books online. You know, sometimes people think that we're somehow hiding this from folks. I just paused long enough to say that not only could our King James only friends obtain this kind of information, but our Muslim friends could find this information as well. We openly present this stuff to the world and say, here's the data, here's the information. We have confidence in these things. Here's why we do that. So I just mentioned that in passing. Now, let's look at the internal considerations. And this is where, quite honestly, Alan, things for a lot of folks start sounding just a tad bit, not only confusing, but a little bit on the subjective side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's gotten to be more so over the couple decades since I wrote the King James Only controversy, and we'll see why. Initially, when you began looking at the internal considerations, the first thing that you made reference to is that there really isn't anything in this text that immediately jumps out at a person and says, ah, this was a scribal situation where inadvertently there is a deletion of a line because of such things as homoeteleuton or parablepsis or homoarcton or whatever else it might be. Why don't you explain to folks, if you could, why you started with that observation?
There's basically two types of internal evidence. You look at transcriptional evidence. Transcriptional has to do with the scribe and the actual process of copying, what the thought process, there could be purposeful or intended changes or mistakes. There could be unintentional mistakes as well, as you mentioned. And then there's intrinsic evidence. Intrinsic would be looking at the actual, the author's style, the author's vocabulary, the context, and in this sort of case, because it seems like it's a theological clause, a saying of Christ, it's a larger unit, often the transcriptional considerations are not, we're not looking at like a single word here or a scribe could, accidentally forget to, just skip over it, when you're copying, although, that's happened in the past, but normally
when it does happen, it's because of fairly easily recognizable situations. The example I've used in the past, when you have something called homoeteleuton, similar endings, is if we put this in English, if you have a word that ends in ing and you're typing this out, even today as we're copying something from a book or something like that, we type ing or tion, a common ending to a word. Our eyes go back to the original, or as scholars refer to it, the exemplar. And when our eyes go back, we find ing around the same spot on the page that we expected to find it, or tion, and we continue on from there. The problem is we found it one line lower than where we actually ended. And if we're not really paying close attention, and especially if it doesn't result in pure gibberish, we've just accidentally deleted a phrase, a word, sometimes an entire sentence. This happened in 1 John 3:1, where "and such we are" was deleted in an early exemplar by Homo Teleuton. So when scholars see that, and there is something in the text where you've got similar endings at the beginning and the end of this particular phrase or sentence, as we have here, then that weighs very, very heavily on the determination of the textual variant itself. But what you were pointing out in your paper was, there's nothing like that here. There's nothing that makes a scholar go, ah, this is how a scribe could have inadvertently, by errors of sight and errors of thought, deleted this particular text.
Yeah, correct. It's there's no the criteria of like more difficult reading in textual criticism. When you compare two readings. The reading that is more difficult to maybe the scribe's mind is often taken into great consideration, because usually they're trying to smooth out something that's difficult in their apparent mind. But here, that's not the case. We're dealing with a theological statement.
Now, you had a quote. I'm assuming you have your paper with you.
Yeah.
Good. You had a quote on page 7. And I will confess, is it Joel DeLoble?
Yes.
DeLoble. DeLoble is the name. And he makes the following comment on this particular text. He says, "The presence or absence of a complete logion of considerable length and striking content, however, can hardly be attributed to scribal carelessness. Addition or omission of this kind constitutes a deliberate change to the model. It is clearly the product of one particular scribe, given that there is little change that several scribes in different times and places would have introduced a chain." I'm sorry, little chance. Ah, I found a typographical error.
I know.
There is little chance that... I would have to point that out, wouldn't I?
Yeah.
That there is little chance that several scribes in different times and places would have introduced a change of this nature in exactly the same Lucan verse independently from one another. So what he's saying is, and it makes perfect sense, this goes back to one point in time. It's either an insertion or a removing of it. The idea that when we especially like we look at Swanson, that you have one scribe in Codex Alexandrinus putting in his version, and then another scribe for D putting in his, and another scribe for 33 putting in his, all putting them in the same form at the same place independently of one another, just simply as about as likely as, you know, lightning striking you 14 times at the same point or something like that.
It's just
not really gonna happen in that way. So now maybe we can summarize what do most scholars say about the internal evidence? Looking at the scribes and what's going on, this has become one of the big things. And this is where you are right now. You're taking classes from these folks. You mentioned that you were taking a class from Eldon J. Epp. For the folks watching or who will be watching on video, as long as our video is functioning correctly today, hopefully. Oh, good. You told me about this book. But I don't think you have it, at least from what you said. You didn't seem to indicate it because you're a poor seminary student. But Perspectives on New Testament Textual Criticism by Epp. I mean, this thing, if you whack somebody with this thing, you probably go to jail for assault with a deadly weapon. It is humongoloid, about 850 pages. And I would assume these are collected essays 1962 to 2004 by your professor for this particular class. He's been at this for quite some time. It is a massive tome. And he is one of the leaders in developing this idea of looking at the cultural and theological settings of the scribes. So would that be a fair statement to make along those lines?
Yeah, I would say that is, you know, his specialty is Codex Bezae and theological tendencies and Acts. He's written quite a bit on, and another loop as well.
And so the idea there is you look at especially the theological and cultural issues that are quote-unquote hot at the particular point in time where it seems a variant arises, and you analyze these in reference to what the tendency of the scribe would have been. And so what, in essence, is the primary argumentation being put forward in regards to this variant by textual scholars today based on internal evidence?
Well, you know, as a caveat, the intrinsic evidence, we're looking at an author's style and vocab, it's really limited. It's very subjective. I mean, obviously, when you look at an author's, you know, vocabulary, well, that would be like saying, you know, Dr. Wade, I'd like to take two letters that you've written in your life,
right,
and that's the pool of your vocabulary. That's the extent of your vocabulary. And not even taking into consideration context or what you wrote, you know, and I mean, it's very limited. So that's just one example of how this can be subjective. But some of the, some who would argue that this is an excision, that is, that they would argue for the longer reading, that this reading is part of Luke. They would, namely, there's three arguments that they would adduce that I've come across. One is that it fits a Lucan theme of forgiveness and ignorance, you know, in Acts, let's see here, Acts 3:17, 13:27. The problem with that, and that's fine, okay, it fits a Lucan theme of forgiveness, but it's kind of an ignorance. It's kind of a double-edged sword, you know, because one could turn around and say, well, how do you know that the scribe was looking for a motif and looked for some floating Domenico Logian out there, a saint of Jesus that did not make into the canonical Gospels, and wanted to, looking for a theme that would be comport with Lucan style. So, it kind of cuts both ways. So I think, a subjective argument. Though there are, you know, they can be legitimate in some context, but in this, I don't think so. Another argument is kind of similar to this, that there's a parallel with Stephen. You know, Stephen is, mm-hmm, you know, being persecuted, and he asked the Lord to forgive his persecutors. Once again, you know, some would say, well, see, Luke was having this parallel with Stephen, but once again, you know, a scribe could say, well, he was looking at accounts in Acts and looking for parallels that could fit with that. So that's kind of just a synopsis, you know. I don't want to minimize, you know, their arguments there, but given the amount of time that we have,
right,
a second argument is the fall of Jerusalem. They would say that the fall of Jerusalem was evidence that, you know, the Jews were not forgiving, so scribes did not want to appear that Jesus' prayer went unanswered.
Mm-hmm.
So they,
mm-hmm,
you know, they expunged that the saying. Once again, the problem with that is, you kind of, when you're quoting giving that quote, is a scribe. What's the probability of several scribes, you know, different times and different places, that is going to excise,
right,
that reading?
Right.
I mean, so I don't.
It would have
that
to go back to one original person who did that. Let me read real quickly what Bruce Metzger says, and then we can sort of bounce this around a little bit. In his textual commentary, he says, the absence of these words from such early and diverse witnesses as the ones we already went over is most impressive and can scarcely be explained as a deliberate excision by copyists who, considering the fall of Jerusalem to be proof that God had not forgiven the Jews, could not allow it to appear that the prayer of Jesus had remained unanswered. At the same time, the Logion, though probably not a part of the original Gospel of Luke, bears self-evident tokens of its dominical origin. Let me translate that. Dominical, from the Lord, coming from the Lord, and was retained within double square brackets in its traditional place, where it had been incorporated by unknown copyists relatively early in the transmission of the third gospel. It sounds very similar to what he said about John 7:53-8:11 as well, in regards to having an origin with Jesus, but not having been part of the original itself. That's what he says. Now, I don't remember if you looked at this in your paper, but Bart Ehrman, in his works, and in fact one of the more recent ones, this is another Brill publication, Studies in the Textual Criticism of the New Testament, pages 384 and 385, this is what he has to say. It is interesting to consider the manuscript tradition of Luke 23 in light of these issues. Let me back this up just a little bit. I jumped way too far into this. Let me back up to page 384. I have already mentioned one of the passages that creates some uncertainty among modern exegetes over the question of Luke's view of the culpability of the Jews in the death of Jesus. Luke 23:34. "We're being crucified," Jesus prays, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing." Modern readers may think Jesus is praying for the Romans, who are responsible for crucifying him. But it should be remembered that in Luke, Pilate delivered Jesus up to their will, that is, the will of the Jews, and that they then let him off to be crucified. Moreover, in the book of Acts, it becomes quite clear that it was the Jewish people who were responsible for Jesus' death, even though they acted out of ignorance. In any event, we know from comments made by Christian fathers that this is how the passage is read in the early church, as a prayer that God forgive the Jews for their involvement in the death of Jesus. But what were early Christians to make of this prayer? For as I've already intimated in my comments on Barnabas and Melito Sardis, there was a decided movement away from thinking that God would or should forgive Jews for what they did, as Christians became increasingly inclined to think of Jews as Christ killers. We know from other sources of the 2nd and 3rd centuries that Christians began blaming the destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman armies in 70 CE on the Jews themselves, not for a foolish uprising against the power of Rome, but for killing Christ, whose death was avenged by the destruction of the city and the slaughter of its inhabitants. What were such Christians to make of the fact that Jesus had prayed for the forgiveness of the Jews? Clearly they had not been forgiven. Was Jesus' prayer not heard, or maybe he had never uttered the prayer in the first place? It is interesting to consider the manuscript tradition of Luke 23 in light of these issues, for as it turns out, there is a textual problem with verse 34, the prayer of forgiveness. Starting with our earliest surviving manuscript, the 3rd century papyrus called P75, and continuing with some other best known and most important witnesses, the prayer, in fact, is completely omitted by some manuscripts. In these witnesses, Jesus had never asked God to forgive the Jews for what they were doing. When confronted with a textual situation like this, scholars, of course, need to decide what Luke's gospel originally said. In some manuscripts, Jesus prays to the Jews to be forgiven, and in others, he does not. Which is the original reading, and which is the altered reading? In this case, some scholars have argued that it is the shorter text, without the prayer of forgiveness, that is actually original, and the scribes have added the prayer to Luke's account. But why would they do so? The most popular explanation is a bit complicated, but it goes something like this. In the book of Acts, the first Christian martyr is Stephen, who is stoned to death for his proclamation of his faith in Jesus. Immediately before he dies, Stephen prays, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." Stephen, Jesus' follower, was forgiving toward his executioners. Would Jesus himself be any less so? According to this theory, scribes who wanted to heighten the parallel between Jesus' death and Stephen's added the prayer to Luke 23. That's why it's found in some manuscripts, but not in others. This is a clever argument, but there are compelling reasons, I'm still reading Ehrman, to reject it. For one thing, as interpreters of Luke and Acts have long observed, the many parallels between Jesus and the gospel and his followers in Acts were put there by Luke himself. Jesus receives the Spirit in his baptism, so do his followers. Jesus is empowered by the Spirit to proclaim God's word, so are his followers. Jesus heals the sick, casts out demons, raises the dead, and so do his followers. Jesus is largely rejected by the Jewish people, so are his followers. Jesus is opposed by the Jewish leaders, etc., etc., etc. And so it seems likely that it is he who has adduced a prayer on behalf of the executioners, both by Jesus in Luke 23 and by Stephen in Acts 7. I do find it interesting that he clearly holds to a Lucan early authorship of both these works. Moreover, it is worth noticing that when Luke creates such parallels, he typically does so not by repeating the words of his gospel in the book of Acts, but by expressing the parallels in other words. This matters because Stephen does not utter the same prayer as Jesus, but a differently worded one with similar meaning. What about scribes? We know that early Christian scribes often harmonized different accounts of the New Testament with one another. That is to say, when they ran across the same story in different places, they would make them word for word the same. For example, the Lord's Prayer in Luke, which scribes changed so that it read exactly like the Lord's Prayer in Matthew. In other words, scribes created harmonizations that were verbatim alike. The prayer of Luke 23, however, is not the same as the prayer in Acts 7. It appears then that it was not created by scribes wanting to harmonize two accounts as put there by Luke himself. So, Ehrman's position is that this is original and that, in essence, it derives from a growing anti-Jewish polemic in the 2nd century. And he uses this as an example a number of times. It's become one of his favorite examples, in fact, to use Luke 23:34. Now, so the question I would have for you is, your conclusion was not that at all.
Well, two quick responses to that was, then I'd like to get your responses. Number one, first, some have argued, though, that because of the anti-Judaic bias, it actually argues for its it would support the interpolation, because if Autois, that is them, the antecedent who Jesus is asking for forgiveness, is the Roman soldiers, the argument is that asking for forgiveness for the Roman soldiers would bolster or reinforce guilt upon the Jews.
Right.
And so that cuts
both directions.
Yeah, that's exactly. Once again, here's the subjective internal evidence cutting both directions. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting argument. If there's anti-Judaic tendencies in the Western, tradition, where is the interpolation found? Mostly in the Western. So that's,
in other words, this is really something that concerns me on a broader level, and I'm trying to figure out in a very brief amount of time I have left how to express this in a short addition to the second edition of the King James Only Controversy, but I am concerned about the movement in textual criticism that, in essence, and I recognize that looking at the context of scribes and the life that they live and things like that is important, but I cannot read the minds of people who were transcribing texts 1,500 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I have made some pretty silly errors sitting in an air-conditioned office with fluorescent lights at a computer that does spell checking with LASIK surgery. I've made some pretty odd transcriptional errors when I was copying something out of a book. I didn't have to worry about the heat. I didn't have to worry about the light. I wasn't writing with a quill. I was typing on a very nice modern computer. And it would be completely silly for someone to read into the errors that I made something about, that derives from my theology or something like that. It didn't have anything to do with that at all. It was just simply a mistake of my mind, a distraction that had nothing to do with my cultural context or anything else.
Right.
And so I am rather concerned when people today try to mind read people that we don't even know their names. We don't know what their theology was. We don't know what their interests were. We don't know if they're still thinking about some sort of bocce ball tournament they had the night before with the other monks in the cave or something. We don't know. We have no way of knowing.
Right. And that's why go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's why in my paper I really stress the external evidence.
Yeah.
Obviously, I had to deal with, certain internal considerations and try to give some plausible reason for its excision,
right?
And I suggested that a plausible reason would be a numerical motivation, that is.
Right.
But I highly qualified that by what I mean by numerical motivation is that the symbolism, symbolism in the second century, and I know Hengel has argued that the four Gospels came together as canonical as a unit by the mid-second century. And so it was very much in the mind of scribes how many sayings of Christ there were. And, the seven sayings of Christ, the other six sayings of Christ have no textual doubt. But if you have six, the number seven was, that was to think of Jesus having six sayings on the cross seriously would have been sacrilegious. It's not just, that's an unfavorable number. There was a motivation to have,
a seven.
Yeah, seven perfect numbers. Now, again, I highly qualified that. I had to give some plausibility. And there's maybe a couple other reasons, how this made it into why a scribe would, bring this into the text. But that wasn't my argument. My argument was the external evidence, because that is highly subjective. So.
Yeah, and it's very difficult, even with the alleged canons of internal evidence, shorter readings over longer readings. People argue that and say, well, you're just picking one particular text type because of that. That automatically gets rid of the Byzantine. And besides that, there seems to be some evidence that especially the early papyri manuscripts were more tended toward missing something than adding something in. And so, I mean, people argue on both sides of that. Once you get into this subjective area, you know, Bart Ehrman can weave his particular context. But the problem is we don't know that that's what the context was. We have no way of knowing that any scribes that touched this text were overly concerned about the whole issue of interpreting whether them was only an application to that particular point in time and the soldiers at the foot of the cross, or them as in mankind, them as in the Jews, all that stuff. Yeah, there may have been discussions of those things, but how do we know that the particular scribes themselves were a part of those discussions? We don't know that. We can assume it, but we don't know that. They might have very different ideas. We might be very surprised if we went back in history and started talking to these guys and discovered that their interests were completely different than what we thought they were. And when that mind reading becomes the way you determine the text, that really concerns me, especially when you have the kind of external evidence that we have in this particular instance. And so I was looking for it here, as I recall, right toward, here we go, the conclusion. In essence, you said, in my estimation, given the judgment of the weight of both the external and internal support, it is reasonable to place about a 75 to 9% degree of probability the longer reading is an early scribal insertion into the transmission history. Now, obviously, just as with the letters that the UBS places on variants A, B, C, D, et cetera, I think they got rid of the D's. But anyway, that is subjective in and of itself, you know, the range you're giving it. But you're going primarily with the external evidence at that point, and it seems like the primary weight that you come down on is there is such a wide distribution genealogically and geographically in the lack of the reading that simply can't be ignored.
Right, and that's what I concluded. And like I said, my main paper was on external evidence. I dealt with internal considerations as well. And there's one thing, though, that I did not bring into my paper, which I actually was hoping you might be able to, and I think this might be your interest as well, and I hope you can discuss this before time runs out, and that is maybe some of the theological implications to this.
Yeah, there are theological implications. There are major theological implications, and I think one of... let me back up just a moment. I need to put this on the blog sometime. I've been thinking about doing this for a long, long time. I'm sure Accordance can do this, and of course, Alan has been a long-time advocate of the Mac platform, and I have only... over the past month or so, Rich is rolling his eyes. No, come to see the truth. I've come to see the light, and I have discovered the joys of computers that actually work. But anyway, I don't know if Accordance can do this, but in BibleWorks, one of the things that I've set BibleWorks up to do is that when I have the various Greek texts, if I have the Byzantine platform, I have the Nesiolon, maybe Stephanos or something like that, BibleWorks can put color in the background of words that vary from the standard text that you choose. And so, in other words, when I bring up the Greek reading panel where I'm reading the Greek and I have different versions, it will mark in each one where there's a variant in the textual readings, which is extremely useful.
Yeah, Accordance has that. Well, in fact, I have that right up there, and you're right. It's very useful. You can see, you don't even have to read the text. You know if there's a variant and what kind of variant, actually, the nature of it.
Exactly. Now, what's amazing to me is, as I scroll through the text, the vast majority of the text does not have any color in it. Yes, there are variants, but the vast majority of the text is the same between all these printed editions of the Greek New Testament. They come from very different perspectives. And what that means is, when we get to the theological aspect of this, I remember, it's amazing the things that stick in your mind from your youth. I remember sitting in a class that my father was teaching back in Pennsylvania. We left Pennsylvania when I was 11. So somewhere around 8, 9, 10 years of age, I'm sitting in the back of a room, and my dad's teaching on proper methods of interpretation. And don't ask me why a kid of my age would have remembered this, but I remember him talking about textual variants and emphasizing to us that there is no doctrine of the faith that is based upon a single verse of the Bible that contains a textual variant, and that further, we should not base huge and expansive conclusions, dogmas and doctrines and so on and so forth on a text that has a meaningful textual variant within it. Now, I remember that as clear as day, and that's what leads me to my conclusions on this particular subject, and that is there are a lot of folks who will utilize this text. They'll say, aha, you see, here's clear evidence that there is no specific elective will in God because Jesus' prayer is just this general thing. Now, I can't remember, I'm sure someone has, but in the general uses of this text that I have seen, there is this general assumption that that autois means the world. In other words, the very, very opposite of what the early scribes and textual scholars are talking about, where they're going, well, is it the Romans? Is it the Jews? All of a sudden, it's just meant to be them, everybody. Mm-hmm. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. And sort of taken that way to mean, aha, here is the clear indication. The only way that the Father could forgive them is if the atonement is made for them. And therefore, that's what we need to do with this text. And I had never seen anyone addressing this who started off by saying, well, you know, we need to be careful pushing this text to make that kind of conclusion in light of the fact that there is a textual variant at this particular point. I had never seen any. I'm not saying that I've read everything there is to say to read in Luke 23, but going through seminary and reading lots of books on theology and things like that, I had not run into that. And so I think that's one of the first lessons that we need to probably take from that.
Yeah, and don't universalists also cite this?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Yeah, they do.
Because they want to, you know, work that into this idea. And so I don't think, what I think we should do with a text like this is we should start with the recognition that there is a serious question to be offered concerning the nature of this text itself. It's not found in Matthew. It's not found in Mark. Obviously, if there's a parallel text like that, that would make a huge difference in how we read it. But then we need to be very careful that as we read it, we look at it carefully. Who is the object? What is the purposes here? But we cannot come to a dogmatic conclusion that says, oh, yeah, all that stuff in Ephesians 1 where there really isn't any serious textual variation whatsoever that changes its meaning, and all that stuff in Romans 9 where, again, there isn't a serious textual variant that changes its meaning, we get to throw all that out because of our particular understanding of what autois is and the reading of Jesus' prayer in Luke 23. So I think that's where we need to be very careful.
Yeah, it's variant, in the, like you said, most pastors may not even are aware of this, but it is interesting to note, though, real quick, that Mel Gibson, in his yes, poignant film, The Passion of Christ, places these words on Jesus' lips not once,
but twice.
and so I find that kind of a little bit ironic.
I'm certain that Mel is probably unaware of the textual variant,
yeah,
too. But
yeah.
Well, Alan, thank you very much for joining us on the program. That was a fast hour, wasn't it? Well,
that was the fastest hour that I've had in a long time.
Don't you wish?
We could talk probably for another hour.
We probably could. But I think most of the people in the audience would not be listening. So
no, but when you get two textual critical Greek geeks talking, you know,
they'll talk forever, as you are right now. We're out of time. We'll see you all on Tuesday. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.